We're told that the first performance of the Seventh Symphony of Beethoven took place in Vienna on December 8, 1813, at a charity concert that also included the premiere of Wellington's victory in the Battle of Vittoria. It was one of the most splendid successes of Beethoven's life. The concert was repeated 4 days later at the same benefit prices and raised a large sum of money for the aid of Austrian and Bavarian troops wounded in the Battle of Hanau. More important from the musical point of view, it marked the real arrival of popular recognition that Beethoven was the greatest living composer. The new symphony contained difficulties that the violin section declared unperformable during rehearsals. Beethoven persuaded the players to take the music home and practice overnight, a concession almost unheard of at the time. The rehearsal the next day went excellently. The composer, Louis Spohr, who was playing in the violin section for that performance, has left in his memoirs a description of Beethoven's conducting during the rehearsal, a remarkable enough feat since Beethoven's hearing was by then seriously impaired. Spohr writes, "Beethoven had accustomed himself in his conducting to indicate expression by all manner of singular body movements. So often as a sforzando occurred, he tore his arms, which he had previously crossed on his breast, with great vehemence asunder. At piano, he crouched down lower and lower as he desired the degree of softness. If a crescendo then entered, he gradually rose again, and at the entrance of the forte, jumped into the air. Sometimes, too, he unconsciously shouted to strengthen the forte." Words of Stephen Ledbetter from the Aspen Music Festival program notes. In Symphony No. 7, we learn there is no slow movement. The allegretto that the first audiences liked so much is relaxed only by comparison with what comes before and after. A subtly unstable wind chord begins and ends the movement. It is a chord in A minor, the home key, but with a so-called wrong note in the bass. When we first hear it, it sets up the walking music of the lower strings. When it reappears at the end, it is not so much a conclusion as a slightly eccentric preparation for the explosion of the symphony's next movement. In that scherzo's contrasting trio, which may or may not be a quotation of a pilgrim's hymn, Beethoven marked it to go very much less fast. And ever since Arturo Toscanini took it strikingly faster than his colleagues, conductors and critics and others have not ceased to argue about just what Beethoven meant. How much less is very much less. That from Michael Steinberg, writing for the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra. Well then, how fast is very much less fast? That's just one of the seemingly innumerable decisions conductors have to make when leading an orchestra in a performance, even when the markings are abundantly clear. Maynard Solomon describes the opening of the second movement of the Seventh Symphony in this way, in theatrical terms. The slow movement, he says, is suspended between representations of indeterminacy, famously framed by tonic chords that serve at the start swiftly to draw a curtain, evoke a sense of restlessness, set a stage, dim the lights, descend in one quick exhalation of the winds from forte to pianissimo, opening a space within which the rhythmic action may commence. Thank you. Just imagine how important it is for a conductor and orchestra to get the opening of that movement right in order to achieve ultimately what Solomon suggests. In the end, having written itself into existence, this movement erases itself and disappears into the ambiguous harmonic cloud from which it had originated, into a region that cannot be measured in meters or feet. What if you're part of an orchestra meeting a new conductor to perform Beethoven's Symphony No. 7? And what if that conductor, over the course of her life, has heard the Cleveland Orchestra at Severance Hall time after time? And to use the common phrase, she's been blown away by the way the Cleveland Orchestra strings play when the score is marked pianissimo. Perhaps the new conductor doesn't make a big deal about moving from fortissimo to pianissimo in the opening of the second movement of the seventh as she prepares the orchestra, but because she is so sensitive, so aware of the power and importance of shaping phrases carefully, the orchestra would surely get something from her, something fresh, authentic, and from her own direct knowledge of what magic a symphony orchestra can make when care is taken with such details within the larger context of the piece itself. That's speculation, but what is not speculation is that after Mélisse Brunet led the Northeastern Pennsylvania Philharmonic in a performance of Beethoven's Symphony No. 7, she was offered the position of apprentice conductor before the day was out. And then, when Lawrence Lowe moved off to take a position in Syracuse, there was no question that Mélisse Brunet would succeed him as music director and conductor of the Northeastern Pennsylvania Philharmonic. A native of Paris, Mélisse Brunet began her studies on the cello and also learned to play the trumpet, French horn, and piano. She holds diplomas from the Paris Conservatoire and the Sorbonne, as well as a professional studies diploma from the Cleveland Institute of Music and a doctorate in conducting from the University of Michigan. Aside from Pierre Boulez, her mentors have included Kenneth Kiesler, Lawrence Lowe, and Joel Smirnoff. She also took part in international workshops where she studied with Marin Alsop, Gustav Meyer, David Stern, and George Mester. The New York Times tells us the French conductor Claire Gibeau has spent a lifetime battling the gender barrier in classical music. In 2019, she co-founded La Maestra, a biennial international competition for female conductors in Paris that draws more than 200 contestants from some 50 countries. Mélisse Brunet was recently invited to take part in that competition, and as a result, she was asked to be one of the conductors featured in a documentary titled Maestra, directed by Maggie Contreras, that had its premiere last June at the Tribeca Film Festival in New York. This past December, at the time of the Philharmonic's holiday concert, Mélisse Brunet paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about her life in conducting, her passion for classical music, and we learned first about why and how conducting became her chosen path.
It was about high school or late middle school, and I was playing the cello in the School of Music orchestra, you know, small orchestra, and we were playing a symphony by Mozart. I did not know much about that Mozart at that time in my life, and I felt extremely bored. This is correct. I remember very deeply that feeling. And I did not have the opportunity to jump on the podium. But what I realized while playing is that I had choices. I had the choice to let it go, which is not too much of my character. And I had the choice to know my cello part very, very well to enjoy it. But I thought, if I'm the only one knowing my part very well and no one else around gets it, I might still be even frustrated, not only bored, but frustrated. My other choice is to become a conductor, because then I am the one who will dive into the score and discover what that gentleman Mozart thought of writing, because he did not wake up one day thinking, I'm going to write boring music. That's my goal in life. You know, never, never, ever. You can be sure of that. You know, we don't have any recording from then, but he never thought like that. So he thought sharing wonderful music with people around him. And I wanted to find that joy, that passion, that wish to share and dive into it as a conductor. So that's when I had the idea of becoming a conductor, and it never left me.
Now, at that moment, though, you didn't have any concept because you had such passion. You weren't thinking, yes, but I can't do it because I'm a girl.
No, you know, I never thought like that. I think my generation, you know, born in the late 70s, everything was never really referring to young women. So if you would watch movies with heroes and things, it was always men, you know. So I identified to them and I thought I also can do it. I never thought gender, you know, separation, because I had not analyzed, oh, it's only men everywhere in the books I read, in the movies I watch, in the music I listen to. I did not have that awareness. And I just thought, I can do it, very naively. I was like, yeah, of course, no problem. It took me many years from that realization until the time I could go on a podium and start conducting. And also it took the time to, I mean, I had to fight myself, because after a while I realized, there are no women conductors. And then my parents told me, you know, Melis, you can do whatever you want in life, but we want for you to make a living. And there are no women conductors, so it's probably not the right path here. My teachers at the conservatoires were also like, oh, forget about it, there are no women out there, you know. So it was very, very lonely for decades, you know, and me fighting and finding my own path and fighting everybody on, you know, in my head and thinking, I can do it, I can do it, I know I can make a difference, and believing in myself, you know, and until now I can do my job and change the life of other people.
So there is something in your character that says, okay, right?
Yeah, yeah. I'm definitely a big fighter, you know, and I think the movie Maestra shows that part in me because of all the hardships I've experienced since I was a little kid. And I think also it's rooted in my DNA, you know. Part of my family is from Spain and fought during World War II and fought against Franco, the dictator, and were in the resistance and they experienced extreme hardship. My grandmother, she would bike in the south of France, in the liberated France, bike to bring food to the resistance. You know, we're a family that did not really take things, you know, lightly, you know, because it's a fight at times to be able to become yourself, because sometimes it doesn't fit society or it doesn't fit what your caregivers have in mind for you. So it's not always easy for all of us. And some of us will try all of their life to become themselves and not always be successful. Some of us can be successful at that. Some of us will not realize, you know, our potential and things like that. So yeah, it's a complicated question.
Did you come to the States to study? Was that the reason that you came?
Yes. I was supposed to stay only 4 months as an exchange program with the Paris Conservatoire. I arrived in Cleveland with the Cleveland Institute of Music. I was, yeah, I'm going to take 4 months. Then I was going to pass my master's at the Paris Conservatoire. And I had a lot of cliches about America. I did not like America, you know, all the cliches we hear in any countries. Horrible cliches, like probably the cliches we hear about France in America, you know. And I came in America on January 8, 2010, Cleveland, Ohio.
Cold.
Yes. But I loved it. I fell in love with the country immediately. I fell in love with the people. People were so nice. It was the opposite from what I had heard all of my life. And people were so nice and smiling despite having very hard life, having to have 2 or 3 jobs a day and still smiling. And I was stunned. I was, this is my place. This is me. This is how I am. Because America recognizes kindness as a strength. And friends see kindness as a weakness. And I think I am kind in my heart, and I know it is a strength. And I think that's also why this country is a lot more successful, because kindness is a strength.
Did you get to hear the Cleveland Orchestra? Who was the music director then?
Well, already Franz Welser-Möst was a music director. And yes, I was at almost all the rehearsals and concerts when I did not have classes or I was not traveling. But I was all the time at Severance, you know, hiding there at first. You know, I found sneaky paths to enter the hall, and at one point I was discovered. So I gave my resume to Franz Welser-Möst, and they allowed me to stay very nicely at all the rehearsals. So I listened to, I mean, I came to the US because the Cleveland Orchestra had been my favorite orchestra since I was 17 years old. And when I had that opportunity to go study in Cleveland, I was, I will be able to listen to them. And so, yes, I would not have missed that for anything in the world. And I remember my first impression during a rehearsal was the strings. It was, I had never heard strings like that ever. They were playing five pianos, like pianissimo. And it sounded like that, like everybody was one person with still warmth, but the discretion of a five piano dynamic. And I mean, I had heard them on disc and things, but it's a different thing to experience live in the hall, the level of the entire orchestra. But for me, it was the strings that really shook me the most at that point.
How did you negotiate your life so that you could come here and make this your place?
Yes, it's a very important question that often we take for granted, that if you want to stay, you stay. But no, it's very complicated, and it brought a lot of stress and anxiety in my life for years, because, you know, when you're a student, you've got a student visa. And so I signed up after my exchange program. I went to Paris, finished my master's, and immediately the very same summer came back for a professional studies degree at the Cleveland Institute of Music. But then it was the end of my studies, and I said, this is my home. I want to stay, you know, but I can't. So I was trying to find jobs, and it was not a time when it was yet open for women. So I took a year applying for jobs, taking auditions, meeting people everywhere. And at the same time, I applied to further my studies for a doctorate program. And I got into many programs, and I elected the University of Michigan for a doctorate in orchestral conducting. And then went to Ann Arbor for 3 years, very intense year of a doctorate program, you know, which changed my life in so many ways. And then towards my last year of studies, I still want to stay, it's still my home. Not 1 minute I wanted to be back in France ever since I've been here, you know. So I was like, yeah, okay, let's apply to jobs now, because you need to think what to do to be able to stay. And I applied to jobs, and I won the position of director of orchestral studies at Appalachian State University in Boone, North Carolina. And so I went there for 5 years. And yes, and the university sponsored my green card.
What prompted you to apply here to be
apprentice conductor?
Yes.
So it was in 2015, and it was my second year of doctorate studies at Michigan. And I was applying to a lot of jobs, you know, because I wanted a job, I wanted to stay, I wanted to be able to be a conductor. And I had seen apprentice conductor in Northeastern Pennsylvania Philharmonic. I had done my research, and I had seen that they had a women apprentice conductor, Michelle Merrill. And I was, oh, wow. That's great, you know, because that gives hope. But at the same time, in the back of my mind, I was, well, if they just hired a woman, I've never seen an orchestra who hires two women in a row yet. So I applied, was invited as a finalist, you know, because you had many rounds of interviews, sending your resume, having interviews on the phone. And then you were invited as five finalists to come conduct the orchestra in Beethoven 7. And I listened to them a little bit rehearsing with Larry. All of us could listen to them like for 10 minutes. And I was, wow, a really good orchestra. And then I took the audition, and it was immediately like lightning, like falling in love with each other, with the orchestra, the way they played. And they were so excited with the musical ideas I was bringing. There was so much energy that when I left stage, I knew it was really good audition. But you never know, even if it's really good, sometimes it doesn't go through for whatever reason. But I came back to the hotel and got a phone call, and they wanted to offer me the job. And I was, hallelujah! Yeah. And I must thank Larry Lowe for that, you know, because he must have been the first man at this time to have taken two women apprentice conductors in a row, which I'm not sure a lot of orchestras have done since. And for him, it was not the gender that matters. It was just what you can do, what do you bring, you know. And he's been a fantastic mentor and now he's a fantastic friend.
We talk about magic and chemistry and so forth, but it really does happen with orchestras and conductors. There's that energy, and we don't know how to talk about it, I don't think, as lay people, about what that energy is.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's been really studied by scientists yet. I'm sure it will be discovered in the future. But I would compare that also to a very romantic idea I have of armies in the past. If you had a general or commander of the army, you know, the old times when they were going on the field. When you talk to the people, you have ways of, in such a matter of a war, when you risk your life, right? You could have the people you talk to being fearful of their lives. You could have the people you talk to being energized to go fight. Or a lot of things that through the talking, through your body language, you can pass through the people in front of you, which we call manipulation as well, because if you look at René Riefenstahl's, you know, movies with Hitler and things, you can see all the process of manipulating through that kind of events. But there is something in the chemicals, in the electricity, in the body language, in the looks, in the tone of the voice, that does impact the people in front of you. So to me, it is really important that when I am in front of the orchestra, that it's never about me. It's about the music, it's about the composer, it's about the music that is in front of us. And I want for them, the musicians, to feel very good, but so good that they want to give their best. So how do you do that when you have a group of 80 people? How do you make that most of them, it's impossible to have all of them in that spirit, but how do you make that most of them will want to give their best for the music? Not for me, not to satisfy me, not to satisfy themselves. You know, it's really just, wow, let's make that wonderful music together and give our best. And I don't know how it works, but it works. It's a combination of a lot of things. I think combination of being authentic, being driven by the right reasons, and probably a form of humility as well that the people will sense. You know, I think everybody likes to have a leader that is somewhat humble and passionate and caring.
And it's clear, having stood to your right, that you have a tremendous sincere respect for each one of them.
Oh, yeah.
It just is clear.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, they are high-skilled workers, high-skilled human beings, and you cannot that's a way of my life, you know, with whomever I am. Like, for example, I had a lot of work done in my home right now, and I had absolute fascination for all the workers coming to my place and talking to them and sharing food with them. And it was just fantastic because it's a field that I don't know much about, but I find them so talented and their knowledge so deep in their area that, yeah, I'm just like a little kid discovering all of those form of arts and being a human being. And I truly believe in every human being and in the potential of everyone to do the good.
You're with the Philharmonic, and how did the competition come? What made you think that this was a worthwhile endeavor?
Very good question, because it's true that generally you take competitions when you're younger, and I was obviously, you know, in my 40s, which is not easy to think I'm gonna put myself in that situation, because a conducting competition or arts competition is not like a 100 meter when you get a photo finish. You know, 100 meters race, you get that photo finish, this is the first, second, third. Right, no problem. Now, if you watch ice skating, arts competition, or conductors, or violin, or whatever competition, it's very subjective. So even though you're very well prepared at your best and whatever, you never know the result. we have all watched competitions that were like, this is weird. So I decided it would be good for me because, as you know now, as a woman conductor, I never had the same chances in my life to evolve and improve and get opportunities and make a living as my male colleagues. And I want to further, you know, my experiences, my future, everything. I want to become better. And that comes with opportunities conducting orchestras, you know, because I cannot practice my orchestra at home. And so I thought it would be a great way of gaining visibility and attraction and experience, because everything was video recording during the competition. A lot of committee members were of international stature, you know, like Deborah Borda or Maureen Alsop. And I know it's a very good orchestra. And also, it's in Paris, and I was born in Paris, and I was, you know, I've had a very complex relationship with France all of my life for different reasons. And I was, yeah, that might be a good time to go back there and try to do my job there. So I applied for the first competition, and unfortunately, it happened in March 2020. So I went there. I was selected for the first competition. And I traveled there. I arrived on March 9. And 2 days later, they announced we are canceling because of the pandemic. So I had to fly back to America. And then they postponed it to September. But at this point, my employer, which was the University of North Carolina, had a travel ban for their employees. So I could not go to the first competition. I applied to the second edition of the competition, and I was again selected, which was a great joy, you know, because a lot of women from the entire world apply, and we were 14 selected. And then I went there in March 2022.
Were those thoughts you had about visibility and gaining experience and being back in Paris to do your job, were all of those things answered in one way or another?
Yes, definitely, in many, many ways. So the competition itself brought some visibility in the way that, even though I got eliminated after the first round, and I got very unlucky to be called to conduct. So if you want, the first round was on 2 full days for the orchestra, and our name was picked. So we did not have a choice. It was luck. And there are 2 positions that are really not good to pick for a competition, which is to be the first one and to be the last one. Because when you're the first, the committee and the orchestra don't know yet what happens. You know, everybody's kind of waking up to the process. And when you're the last, everybody just dreams to go back home and sleep, you know. Well, I got the last one, which was at 10 p.m. on a Friday evening. And when that number was picked for me, I was, oh my God, okay, that's not good luck. But what you need to do, Melissa, I immediately thought about strategy. Your strategy is going to be to wake up the orchestra because they're going to be dead tired by then. So bring energy, energy, and, you know, make a difference so they are still listening and awake with everything. And yes, so I was eliminated after this round, but what was really good is that there was a music critic from Canada who was there and was really impressed with my performance, as well as the head of the TV channel, which is called Arte. It's a European TV channel, which was streaming live the competition. And they were very impressed with my performance. So that helped me, if you want, to have my name out there and to gain that experience. It would have been a lot better to pass at least one round in terms of visibility, you know, but I was not the only one eliminated, and that's the game.
At the same time, how did the documentary enter your life? How were you selected out of the 14, and when did the filming begin?
Yeah. So we were selected for the competition in September of 21. We received a letter that you've been selected. Congratulations. And then by early November, the administration of the competition wrote us and said there is a documentary team from Los Angeles that is separate from us who will do a documentary on this competition. They will be reaching out to you all and getting Zoom interviews with you. So I had my Zoom interview with them. I think everybody had them later in November. And I didn't know them at that time. And I was, yeah, okay, I don't know anything about Los Angeles and movies and things. So I was There was actually the director of the documentary, Maggie Contreras, was on Zoom, and one of the producers, Neil Berkeley, who actually had the idea of the documentary and wanted for Maggie to do it, give her her first opportunity to become a director for this documentary. So they were both on Zoom and asked us a lot of questions and video recorded and things and said, yeah, okay, thank you very much. And then early December, I get an email from Maggie saying, well, we are coming to your place next week.
What
is happening right now? So they kept the process. Of course, they are professionals. So they kept the process for themselves, you know, because we are only subjects. You know, we are not part of the process of making the documentary of the movie. We have no say. So I totally understand that. That was kind of funny to discover what the process is in that world. So they showed up to my place and started the filming. I think they stayed that first time in December. Maybe they stayed 4 or 5 days of shooting nonstop at my place, at my job in Iowa. I lived at the time. They came to my home and I had mic and cameras all the time. And then to my job at the University of Iowa with the students and things. So it was quite the experience. And then they left and no news. You know? And later in February, they said, we are here in 2 days. We come back in 2 days. And they stayed 10 days. Well, at first, they should have stayed a week or less than a week. And Maggie went back to the airport. And I was, yes, I'm quiet. Because I love the process, but it's really draining to have someone filming you all the time. Overall, when you're preparing for an international competition and you have 2 jobs, you know, it's pretty draining. So she was at the airport. And then I get a phone call like 3 hours later. We are back because we thought very so much and with you and we want to record more. And I was like, ah! I love you two guys. So I've discovered more later in the process on how they selected us. So they interviewed all 14 women, but it's an international competition, right? And it was still pandemic times. So they could not travel easily to all countries. Also, they were limited financially. It was very complex, you know, a big budget. Making a documentary is not a Hollywood movie, you know. So they selected women that were kind of easier to reach out to. And they selected, I think, 5 of us at first. But then the cast changed throughout the process. Because 1 week before the competition started, the war in Ukraine erupted. And in the poll of candidates, there were 2 Russian ladies and 1 Ukrainian lady. So that changed the cast of characters. And so there have been some changes around the cast of characters of the competition.
And taking part in it, you certainly learned about how making a documentary works. But with the intensity of the microscope, did you discover things you hadn't known about yourself or about the way your life had unfolded because you were explaining it to these people? Did you have any aha moments for yourself?
Wow, great question, Erica. So what is really interesting is that we had several times of recording. I had December, I had February, and then in March, they were with us. They came pick me up at the airport in Paris, and they were nonstop with us at the hotel. And we didn't know what they were doing of these hours, hundreds of hours of rush. No, you know, I mean, they were with us all the time. So, and we are not the new movie director nor the editor. So we didn't know what they would select. And sometimes we were tired and we said things like, oh my God, I hope it's not on tape. But it was on tape. And what are they going to do with that? You know, that we had no visibility on what the director would select. She's like the composer. So she's keeping all the lines in her head. And then she's creating that art piece and only her knows what shape it will take, what form it will take, and where it's going. So I would say that the aha moments I have had, but it's when I watched it, because I realized that I opened particularly on one topic that is a very strong scene at the end of the documentary. And I opened on a topic that I had never opened on ever before in my life. And I don't know why I opened to it 2 cameras. Which is probably it was the right time, right moment for me to let go of that and be open about it. You know, so watching the documentary has been a very humbling and also helping me to improve in my life.
It's uncomfortable, isn't it?
It is very uncomfortable, and I must say the first time I saw Maggie had the delicacy to come to my place in Iowa to show it to me before it was released, before the world premiere. It was very delicate because I'm definitely the subject who opens the most personally in the documentary. And I really appreciate her tact. And when I watched it, of course, I had friends with me, and of course, it was very emotional. And I realized a lot of things. And a part of me was, do I want to have that on the screen? You know, all of those very private things about me. And we have had very long talks with Maggie. And, you know, she's in the world of documentaries. That's really her field. And she's the one who really helped me realize that when you open like that, you help other people who went through the same experience, sometimes didn't know about it, but will realize that it happened to them and they are not alone. And you also open to people who know they have suffered that and they are thinking, is it normal? And things, and they don't know. And until they see someone else on the screen who's been through that, they are like, oh my God, I'm not alone. And that's what's been striking to me, is that since the world premiere happened at Tribeca, the number of people from that very same evening up until now, I get connections from social media all the time because the documentary is doing festivals. So I get people messaging me from everywhere and telling me, you have no idea how your story resonates with me and how I understand what you went through and how I'm supportive and how beautiful your path is. And I mean, it's wonderful connections, and to see that being showing, you know, that you're fragile, that showing that fragility actually makes a difference in some other people's life.
The question then becomes, because it has affected you so deeply as a person, as a human being, how about in making of music? Will you find, do you suppose, that you'll have even a deeper sense or a richer sense of somebody, I don't know, let's just pick Shostakovich, when you conduct Shostakovich, where there's pain and and anguish or something like that, you won't be afraid to go there because you've just opened a very...
very personal and somewhat painful, but that also allowed me to make changes in my life and realize what has happened. I think I already had found that ability to be open and to show my fragilities years ago, since I've been in America, but it's probably been 6-7 years ago that I found in my art the ability to be vulnerable. And that changed my life. That vulnerability, which I was able to bring to the documentary, and I think that's why also they used me so much. It's because I can show vulnerability, which makes documentaries stronger. So, for example, Joan Baez, whose documentary I Am Noise has just been released, and I believe it's on Netflix now. I was very lucky to watch it part of our festival, our documentary festival in DC. And she was there. She was in the hall, and we were watching I Am Noise. And the fourth quarter of the movie is about very personal things she's experienced, and she's opening and she's showing tremendous vulnerability. Nobody knew that was coming. And watching her on the screen opening up on that made me realize what myself I had experienced very similarly, and what were the methods we were using for coping, which is art and music. And after I was invited to a party where she was, and I went to her and discussed all of that with her, and that made me realize, yeah, I am with her. Like, she helped me as the same way that I've helped some other people through the documentary of Maggie, you know. So I think vulnerability in music and in arts in general and in life really helps with communication and with being happy with yourself, with finding the joy in everyday's life, you know. But mostly I think my experiences and realizing that my experiences, I'm a survivor of many different things in my life. And all of those hardships have really helped me experiencing pain, knowing what pain is, what loneliness is, what despair is, a lot of feelings that many of our composers have experienced themselves. you know, differently, but all of those emotions are human. And at the same time, I've experienced joy and greatness and easiness and everything. And so I'm thankful for all of this history, all of the hardship, and I'm thankful for my strength of character that never had me giving up. And my only addiction was to music, which could have been a lot of other things, but art has really saved me. Music has saved me, and music is my joy. Music is a place where I feel good.
Maëlys Brunet, music director and conductor of the Northeastern Pennsylvania Philharmonic, speaking about her life in conducting and about the documentary Maestra, in which she is featured as one of five women conductors exploring their challenges, their choices, and their joys. The film opened this past June at the Tribeca Film Festival in New York and continues now on the festival circuit. In fact, Maestra was screened this past Sunday at the Boulder International Film Festival. We can hear Maëlys Brunet doing her job, as she puts it, leading the Northeastern Pennsylvania Philharmonic. Next, on April 1st, it's an all-Gershwin program featuring Rhapsody in Blue and How Perfect, an American in Paris. She is now an American. Shortly after we spoke in this conversation in December, December 26th, she was set to be sworn in as an American citizen. So now she will be returning to Paris as an American. After that, on Saturday, June 1st, she will lead the Philharmonic in a performance of Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1 and Symphony No. 2 by Rachmaninoff. For more information, on the web, nepaphil.org, nepaphil.org. And to learn more about Maëlys Brunet herself, she has a website, MELISSEBrunet.com, BRUNET, MELISSEBrunet.com, MaëlysBrunet.com.